Thank you, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here, and since I have a whole hour, I'd like to take this opportunity to appeal for asylum. I think I can make a pretty good case. I bet you're hearing that a lot these days. Okay, the title of my talk is Forms of Attention, Digital Humanities Beyond Representation, and I'm going to see if I can work with a mouse that has to be in two places. The title refers to Frank Kermode's Wellick Library Lectures at Berkeley, which were published in book form in 1985 under the title Forms of Attention. And in his preface, he opens with this remark. By what means do we attribute value to works of art, and how do our evaluations affect our ways of attending to them? Kermode's interest is in canon formation, and in order to understand how quality and reputation are related, he focuses on the history of those unusual objects which vanish from the canon, vanish indeed from view, but are restored after long periods of neglect. The title I've chosen alludes to that book, but I'm interested, as he was, in the way we value and the way we attend to works of art. But more precisely, in what follows, I'm interested in the different forms of attention that we pay to these works in humanities computing and why those forms of attention change over time. Kermode's focus was on the institutional and social forces and sometimes the sheer accidents that shape accepted notions of what is good and what is bad and what is beneath notice. My interest tends more toward a different set of social forces, the technical and the legal, that shape our digital engagement with the works that have survived the process Kermode describes. For as long as there's been humanities computing has been about the representation of primary source materials and about building tools that either help us create those representations or help us manipulate and analyze them. Source materials might be, and have often been, texts, but they might also be drawings, paintings, architectural or archaeological sites, music, maps, textiles, sculptures, performances, or any of the other forms in which the record of human culture and human creativity can be found. Under that description, it might seem that we've been working steadily at more or less the same thing for quite a long time now, more than half a century. It would be a mistake to make that assumption, and it would be a disservice to impute stasis or repetition to the field. In fact, over the half century leading up to now, there have been significant accomplishments and significant changes. As a result of them, and maybe even more, as a result of changes in the world around us, we are, I think, on the verge of what seems to me the third major phase in humanities computing, which has moved from tools in the 50s, 60s, and 70s to primary sources in the 80s and 90s, and now seems to be moving back to tools in a sequence that suggests an oscillation that may repeat itself in the future. But whether or not that pattern ultimately repeats, I think we're arriving at a moment when the form of the attention that we pay to primary source materials is shifting from digitizing to analyzing, from artifacts to aggregates, and from representation to abstraction. In an essay published in 1996 in Victorian Studies and online the year before that, Jerry McGann wrote that to date, computerization in the humanities has been mainly located in work closely associated with the library and with library-oriented research projects. That's a very durable generalization, all the more so because the library represents not only a collection of primary source materials, but also tools for use with those materials, things like reference works, dictionaries, encyclopedias, concordances, or for that matter, critical editions. These are all texts as tools, texts that are composed as tools to be used with other texts, which they sometimes contain, as in the case of a critical edition. The analysis of texts by means of other texts is one of the oldest methods of humanities scholarship, dating back to the earliest days and the oldest traditions in every textual culture. And my point here is not to suggest that the interest in tools and the interest in texts are mutually exclusive. On the contrary, the two are complementary, but one of the two is usually foregrounded as the primary object of attention. Most fields cannot point to a single progenitor, much less a divine one. But humanities computing has Father Busa. I promised Steve I would work this slide in. Who began working with IBM in the late 1940s on a concordance of the complete works of Thomas Aquinas. Shown here with the Pope, he has subsequently survived. The 91-year-old Jesuit has seen this project through generations of computer technology, from punch cards to magnetic tape and ultimately to CD-ROM, pictured on the right there, yours for 1,000 euros, and with a 56-volume print edition appearing along the way. The Index Thomisticus and other early forays into humanities computing, like Reverend John W. Ellison's 1957 Concordance to the Revised Standard Version of the Bible, or Roy Wisby's work on 12th-century German, in the late 1950s and early 1960s were geared towards producing tools, albeit tools that could take the form of texts. The effort, and it was an enormous effort, devoted to these projects was justified on the grounds that the source material was worthy of scholarly attention and that the resulting tool would facilitate the application of that attention. The choice to produce the tool with computer technology was justified on the grounds that the computer, as one participant said, quote, freed the scholar from the tedious, repetitious clerical work and returned him to his real vocation, scholarly research. That choice, to use computer technology to automate repetitious clerical work, was visionary at the time. Even if you live through the changes, it is actually difficult to remember how recently computers and their peripherals acquired some of the features that make them usable for the work of daily life. The first personal computer, meaning the first computer that would fit on your desk, wasn't commercially available until 1973. The first computer with a mouse, 1974. The first laser printer was produced by Xerox in 1978, and it cost $500,000. Optical storage wasn't available until 1980. It wasn't until 81 that the IBM PC was introduced, with MS-DOS as the operating system and a 4.77 megahertz Intel processor. Proportional fonts for display and printing don't become available until the first Macintosh computer is introduced by Apple in 1984. Color monitors on personal computers also become first available with an Apple, the Apple II, in 1977, and on IBM PCs in the 80s. Four colors in 1981, 16 in 1984. It's only in 1990 that we get 800 by 600 pixel resolution in true color, 16 million colors, and 1024 by 768 with a measly 65,000 colors. And, of course, all of this applies to largely standalone computing. Computer networks are invented in the 70s, but not widely used, even in research universities, until the 80s, and not used by the general public until the 90s. My point is that humanities computing projects of the 50s and 60s, before all of that innovation, faced and were shaped by some very basic challenges at the level of representation. As Susan Hockey notes in her chapter on the history of humanities computing in the new Blackwell's Companion, she says, at this time, much attention was paid to the limitations of the technology. Data to be analyzed was either texts or numbers. It was input laboriously by hand, either on punch cards with each card holding up to 80 characters or one line of text, uppercase letters only, or on paper tape where lowercase letters were perhaps possible, but which could not be read in any way at all by a human being. Character set representation was soon recognized as a substantial problem. Various methods were devised to represent upper and lowercase letters on punched cards, most often by inserting an asterisk or similar character before a true uppercase letter. Accents and other non-standard characters had to be treated in a similar way, and non-Roman alphabets were represented entirely in transliteration. It's worth reflecting for a moment on the limitations that Susan's describing here and on their significance in the humanities. Accurate transcription might be accomplished, but only if characters didn't vary too much from the teletype keyboard, and even then it would be necessary to use a variety of idiosyncratic, non-interoperable hacks to note things as simple as capital letters or accents. There were similarly basic limitations in other areas as well. Hockey's chapter continues, most large-scale data sets were stored on magnetic tape, which can only be processed serially. It took about 4 minutes for a full-size tape to wind from one end to the other, and so software was designed to minimize the amount of tape movement. Random access to data, such as happens on a disk, was not possible. Data had therefore to be stored in a serial fashion. This was not so problematic for textual data, but for historical material, it could mean the simplification of data, which represented several aspects of one object, forming several tables in relational database technology, into a single linear stream. This in itself was enough to deter historians from embarking on computer-based projects. Well, those are only a couple of examples, but they may serve to remind us that not only was the nature of the tools proscribed by the limitation of computer technology, but the nature and the features of the source material accessible to the tools were similarly prescribed. In other words, computers were only good for paying certain very limited kinds of attention to certain very limited features of certain very limited subsets of primary source materials in the humanities. Texts in Latin were a good starting point because computers used the Roman alphabet. And if you were concerned with aspects of the text that you could abstract from the artifact by transcription, then you could use the computer's ability to store and retrieve and order and count as an aid in producing text tools like indexes and concordances. On the other hand, if you were interested in information that resisted representation in this medium, for example, the relational social structures that interest historians, then computers in the 1950s and 60s wouldn't have seemed especially useful as tools for paying attention to important aspects of the human record. Naturally, the software tools developed during this period shared the characteristics of other computer technology of the time. Take as an example Two-Step, the Tübingen system of text processing programs, a suite of tools that could be used for text analysis and for the creation of critical editions, which was developed by Professor Wilhelm Ott and others at Tübingen University over 3 decades, beginning in the 1970s. In the Two-Step website's general introduction, we learned that work on Two-Step, quote, began in 1966, when we first designed a series of functions and subroutines for character and string handling in Fortran, and implemented them on the mainframe of the computing center of the University of Tübingen. This made programming easier for projects such as the metrical analysis of Latin hexameter poetry, the concordance to the Vulgate, or the addition and indexes to the works of Heinrich Kaufringer. Proceeding from the experiences gained from those projects, the next step in supporting projects was to no longer rely on programming in Fortran or other high-level languages, but to provide a toolbox consisting of several program modules, each covering one basic operation required for processing textual data. The function of each program is controlled by user-supplied parameters. The programs themselves may be combined in a variety of ways, thereby allowing the user to accomplish tasks of the most diversified kind. It was in 1978 that these programs got the name Two-Step. Well, Two-Step functions include, for those of you like me, who haven't used it, automated collation of different versions of a text, text correction in editor or batch mode, decomposing texts into elements like word forms according to rules provided by the user, building and sorting logical entities like bibliographic records, preparing indexes by building entries from the sorted elements, processing textual data by selecting records or elements, by replacing strings or text parts, by rearranging, completing, compressing and comparing text parts on the basis of rules and conditions, by retrieving numerical values which are already given in the text, like calendar dates or which can be derived from it, such as numbers of words in a paragraph, and transforming textual data from two-step files into file formats used by other systems for statistical analysis or electronic publication. Because Professor Ott and his colleagues continually updated two-step, it acquired the ability to output Unicode and XML, and continued developing well into the age of the web, CGI, web services, SOAP, and the like. All of those features are quite useful if you're preparing an index, a concordance, a critical edition in print, a bibliography, or a dictionary, but they fall within the realm of attention that one can pay to the alphanumeric elements of source material. And the fundamental paradigm on which Two-Step was based is the batch process. As Kaya Milkowski pointed out in an email to Humanist in 1996, he wrote, "To the best of my knowledge, I received my tutorial in two-step in December 1994. There is absolutely no interactivity in two-step at all. Now, some level of interactivity would probably be relatively trivial to create in two-step, but my sense is that the basic algorithms are deeply geared to a batch mode of operating. This doesn't bother me that much, but somehow I doubt that any such set of programs could become popular in this day and age. Tools, too, are subject to fashion. And in 1996, two-step seemed out of step with the times. And yet some of the principles on which it was founded are quite timely still. Modularity, professionality, meaning that it should go beyond off-the-shelf office products to meet the needs of research users, integration, and portability. These are things we still look for in our tools, but we also look for interactivity, networkability, and internal data representations that use open standards. The next generation of tools in digital humanities might be represented by TACT, Text Analysis Computing Tools, developed by John Bradley, here today, and released in 1989. Subsequently, TACT, which was originally a DOS-based program, was ported to the web as TACT Web, where you will still find it. TACT follows a more recent query-based paradigm of computing that grows out of database software. The user installs the software on a personal computer and builds a TACT database of texts or the text that's of interest. TACT queries return keywords in context with user-configurable parameters for what constitutes the context, or they return statistical information about the frequency and distribution of lexical elements in the database, words in a text. In a 1992 paper that Bradley wrote with Jeff Rockwell, the authors note that in working with TACT on their own research problems, computing work was most efficiently done by combining small computing primitives to perform larger tasks. To this end, we used existing software whenever possible, including various Unix tools such as awk, grep, and sort, with larger pieces of software such as TACT and Simca. I love the Simca there. John, you know what Simca is, but how many people in the room? Okay, two, the authors of this article. There's a lesson in there somewhere. However, we were still obliged to write some bridging software in an ad hoc fashion. This brings us to our second observation, that our computing interest required us to continually add new processes to answer new questions. Some of the new software used results of TACT searches. Some read the TACT database directly. Some worked on other intermediate data formats. As mentioned above, we were in a unique position to reuse and reassemble parts of TACT for a range of different purposes. However, it quickly became clear that it would be virtually impossible for anyone else to use the TACT program code to assemble on-the-fly specialized processing as we could, even if they had access to all of it. There are other conclusions in this article, and I'll return to one of them later, but for now I just want to note that the passage I've just read makes it clear that TACT was really a very different kind of tool from two-step. To begin with, it was much smaller. Not a comprehensive suite of tools, but something that you might use alongside grep and sort for a fairly narrowly defined purpose. As the authors tried to use it for more comprehensive investigation of the text, they found they needed to mix it with other tools. In the two-step world, this would have been difficult at best. The two-step documentation actually points out that one virtue of the system is that your text can live inside two-step for all phases of the project. What changes between two-step and TACT is the rise of the database paradigm. TACT assumes queries submitted to the database return results, which are then piped to various external programs, which might in turn send output to other programs. Two-step was fundamentally about text data processing, a term Ott invented to distinguish its focus from word processing software. But TACT is fundamentally a much more narrowly focused tool designed for analyzing the statistical properties of text. Two-step mentions as one of its features the preparation of text for statistical analysis, but the documentation doesn't suggest that two-step itself would actually do that analysis. Well, I'm sort of echoing here something that Patrick said in his talk. Statistical methods in the humanities have had what you might call a limited vogue. Perhaps their widest acceptance was in history in the early 1970s. That acceptance, such as it was, best exemplified in Stanley Engerman and Robert Fogel's book, Time on the Cross, which applied econometric statistical methods to quantitative data gathered from communities in the antebellum South and argued for a reassessment of slavery as socially benign. That outcome caused a considerable backlash in history, and it contributed to the decline in favor in the United States, at least, of this particular form of attention to humanities data. Other humanities disciplines, like English, have found some limited use for statistical analysis in authorship studies and more general kinds of stylometrics, but frankly, there are not that many scholars in any branch of the humanities who are avid users of statistical methods. And it's not because the tools aren't there. It's because, at least until recently, the problems those tools could solve were not ones that were of central importance in the humanities. Statistics are all about measuring the measurable, whereas the humanities are all about effing the ineffable. In fact, the whole model of problem solving is somewhat ill at ease in the humanities. In the sciences, one solves problems in order to move on to other problems. But as Frank Kermode points out, we're not about solving the problem of Shakespeare so we can go on to some other problem and stop paying attention to the bard. Instead of problem solving, the rhetorical model in the humanities is appreciation. We believe that by paying attention to an object of interest, we can explore it, find new dimensions within it, notice things about it that have never been noticed before, and thereby increase its value. Well, although there were computer-based editions before the 1980s, with very rare exceptions, those editions were realized in print. With the advent of Apple's HyperCard and the CD and color graphics in the 80s, a new form of humanities computing appeared. The electronic text designed to be delivered and used in electronic form, hypertextual in its interface, and gradually including more and more graphical content. Some of the very earliest of these texts were new creative works. But from very early on, at least a few people were working on electronic scholarly projects. One of the earliest of these was the Perseus project, founded officially in 87, originally delivered on HyperCard on CD-ROM, published by Yale in 1992 with an accompanying video disc, and for the Mac only. That CD would provide you with a significant sampling of the record of classical civilization on your home computer. There was a second release of the Perseus CD in 96 and a third platform-independent release in 2000. But from 1995 on, the Perseus project has focused on the web as its main mode of delivery. From the beginning, projects such as Perseus included tools, especially texts as tools, like dictionaries. But the focus had shifted. In the foreground now was the artifact, and the reason for that was simple. We now had the ability to produce and share digital images in color. And image-based digital scholarship was a much better fit with the humanities' native paradigm of appreciation. Given the focus on the artifact, it may not be surprising that this sort of humanities computing project, casting about for something to describe its scopes and aims, should have settled on archive as the generic label. Archivists, as soon as they became aware of this usage, pointed out that a true archive was an unintentional record of some activity, which disqualified these highly intentional structures from being considered archives, but that distinction, while important to archivists, was less important to humanities scholars, who saw archives as the storehouses of original artifacts, first and foremost. A digital archive, or an electronic archive, or a hypertext archive, or a web archive, sadly no consensus ever emerged on the modifier, was a storehouse of digital representations of original artifacts. And that was a pretty good description of how many of these projects took shape. They produced, collected, organized, and edited digital representations of artifacts on a theme. That theme could be an author, like Walt Whitman, for example, but it could as easily be an event, like the Civil War. The Whitman Archive, whose homepage is pictured here, is one example, but at the Institute for Advanced Technology and the Humanities, we sprouted archives right and left. None of them, of course, with a long-term plan for preservation. This is a screenshot of the navigational apparatus for the Valley of the Shadow Project, a Civil War history archive that includes church records, maps, images, letters, diaries, tax records, newspapers. The image before you makes it quite clear how literally humanities computing has sometimes taken the term archive in imagining and organizing its work. This is laid out like the floor plan of an archive. You have the newspaper room, the census and tax record room, and so on. In spite of the obvious misappropriation of the term, there are some other interesting historical and etymological implications behind the word archive in the context of digital humanities. An archive is a place where important, often unique, documents are kept. In their origins, and still today, archives sometimes hold the very records, the authenticity of which gives legitimacy to government. And in fact, the Greek root of archive is the word that means government. Archive. Archives also strive for completeness in the records they keep, which is one reason why intentionality is an issue. If an archive, then, is ideally a complete collection of authentic and authoritative records of great importance, then it might supersede the edition or take it to a new level. If you can accurately represent all states of a work, then perhaps you could escape the choices and compromises which print for so long imposed on the telling of history through the lives of the famous, or on critical editions focused on best texts or last editions. This moment in humanities computing, the moment in which we first passed from tools to texts as primary objects of attention in the actual scene of computing, and the moment in which we first realized the computer's ability to represent qualities of the human record beyond one and zero, beyond number and letter, beyond black and white, quite oddly coincided with the heyday of a theoretical turn in the humanities that was largely suspicious of representation. Looking back on that time, from the year 2000, one critic wrote, "In a number of competing and conflicting narratives, the turn towards modernity is diagnosed as a fall into representation. And this diagnosis has been adopted both by nostalgic anti-modernists who see representational epistemology and ethics as a break with the lived immediacy of the Greek polis, and by postmodernists who define representationalism as the persistent vestige of a Western metaphysics unable to truly confront the death of God. But the nosology of representationalism also has a strange habit of passing over into a celebration. While the concept of representation is held responsible for generating certain illusions of reason, reason can only be disabused of these illusions by the notion that the presence promised by representation is nothing other than representation itself. Thus, representation functions as an inherently contradictory notion, at once the sign of reason's failure, as well as being the goal of philosophical maturity. Paradoxically, though, editing, which was already out of fashion in an age of critical theory, did actually acquire some new power in this moment, even though representation itself was suspect on theoretical grounds. It did so not because of an increased representational capacity of the digital medium, but because that capacity allowed editors of a theoretical bent to interrogate representation and editorial theory and editorial practice in new ways. Perhaps these were just illusions of reason, but perhaps in some cases they amounted to philosophical maturity. I don't mean to imply by this slide that I'm accusing Jerry of maturity. The Rossetti Archive became one of the best known of these theoretical editing projects, and not least because its editor was eager to tackle the unknown and push the capabilities of the medium and his colleagues to the limit. The Rossetti Archive had and has the grand ambition not only bring together all the states of the work, text or picture produced by Rossetti, but also to relate those items to one another and to document each of them with bibliographic and textual and historical commentary. The subject for this project was chosen because of his appropriateness to a multimedia treatment, but I doubt that Jerry would disagree with the assertion that in this long experiment, far more has been learned about editing than about Rossetti. All to the good. It is much more important at the moment to reimagine the practice of editing as a form of attention paid to primary source material in this new medium than it is to reimagine Rossetti, who incidentally would have been a good candidate for Frank Kermode's study, having been in and out and then back in vogue during the last century or so. Archive editing projects like the Rossetti Archive do not only represent individual texts, they represent textual genealogies, the relationship between text and works in other media, and often the intertextuality of works by different creators across time and place and media. We'll return to that point, but relationships are the point in this sort of project, and it is ultimately not the object in isolation that poses the greatest challenge, but the object in context, in collections, and in relation. Editorial work at its most fundamental level consists of specifying those relationships. And that specification opens a way for a tipping back in the direction of tools, but more on that later. With storage costs dropping from about $2,000 a gigabyte in 1993 to about $20 a gigabyte in 2000 to about $1 a gigabyte today, image-intensive projects like the Rossetti Archive and the Blake Archive were bound to appear. And while it's been less revelatory in terms of editorial theory and method, the Blake Archive has demonstrated that editing in this medium can really change the way we understand and value significant figures in the humanities. In Blake's case, this has meant a restoration of his work as an artist and his practice as a printer to equal importance with his more abstractable prowess as a poet. The Blake Archive has, I think, forever changed the way students and scholars will encounter Blake. The editors have accomplished this by foregrounding the artifact as an object of attention, subordinating commentary and apparatus, and enabling some operations like comparison that become more important when the artifact is the object of attention. Other examples, this has already been mentioned, the electronic Beowulf. As you get editions like this, tools for working with the artifacts do develop in the context of the edition. They tend to be image-based tools, exploiting the qualities of the carrier medium rather than the statistical qualities of the textual data. The text is still in that picture, of course. It's an object of investigation, and it also appears in annotations and other forms of apparatus. But these are fundamentally image-based tools for working with texts rather than text-based tools for working with texts. Here's another archive project which began by wishing to collect, edit, and cross-index the documentary record of the Salem witch trials held in a number of different real archives. One of the things that these projects do, and the Whitman Archive has been doing it too, is to reconstruct and virtually reunite the documentary record that may be spread across many physical holdings. In the case of the Salem witch trials, the virtual archive contains not only legal records, but also maps, paintings, religious texts, and a partial record, at least, of the culture's reprocessing of the event in various forms of popular culture. Interestingly, in this and a number of other text-oriented projects, mapping turns out to be very important. Tools developed for use with maps, namely geographic information systems, turn out to have application in these textual projects. And I would say that's because one large subset of humanities is about events that unfold in a particular space, real or imagined, over some period of time. And mapping the events is an excellent way of understanding them. And in fact, I don't know if you can really see it, but the little circles on the map of Salem show, we're about in the middle of the timeline in that screenshot, show the rising number of accusations in different parts of the Bay Colony. And one of the things that becomes clear as you run that, really, it's at most a 10-second animation, is that the epicenter of this event was not Salem. It was all over the Bay Colony, and the epicenter was actually elsewhere. Simply by mapping and visualizing information that's there in the documentary record and using tools that were never really intended for use in religious studies projects, you can find interesting new insights into the primary source materials. A limit case of the representational impulse in humanities computing might be the modeling of buildings and sites of historical interest. These have been produced in projects like the Amiens Cathedral Project at Columbia, or the Roman Forum, and many others modeled at the Cultural Virtual Reality Lab at UCLA, led by Bernie Frischer, who's just been appointed director of the Institute for Advanced Technology in the Humanities at Virginia, or in this project, the Crystal Palace, which was produced by Chris Jesse and Will Rourke, working on a project headed up by Michael Levinson at Virginia. They were working from the facsimiles of the original architectural drawings on the left there and modeling them in architectural drawing programs. Modeling projects like these take a step beyond digital imaging of an existing artifact. Usually they're reconstructions in part or in whole, and rather than showing us what's there, they often strive to represent what is no longer there. The benefits of this activity, as in all modeling projects, is that these kinds of projects make explicit what you think you know about the object of your attention, an exercise that often ends up showing you what you don't know, what you forgot, or what you simply got wrong. And actually building the building and making the pieces fit together, a lot was learned about how that building was made. The risks, a spurious sense of certainty is probably the biggest risk in these projects. Owing to the uniform polish and the apparent completeness of the models. It's actually a difficult problem in things like this to show the difference between what you know and what you don't know and your varying degrees of certainty. Earlier in speaking about the Rossetti Archive, I said that archive editing projects represented textual genealogies and the relationship between text and works and other media. This is a picture of those relationships in a small part of the Rossetti Archive. In a very direct sense, you're looking at a picture of the work of scholarly editing. It's also a picture that, for me, represents the turning point in my own thinking, the point at which it started to become clear that you could work with these artifactual representations in some more abstract way. Apparently, it struck Jerry in the same way. He wrote in an essay called Textonics, "Reality or apparition, a quantum order of bibliographical objects becomes accessible to us through computerization. I'm not speaking about the physico-chemical makeup of paper objects, but of the immense number of dynamic relations and functions that comprise the discourse field of social texts. We touch the hem of this garment whenever we open a web browser. The field of textual relations accessible through that digital device is statistically significant at a quantum order. People are trying to build quantum computers precisely to improve controlled access to that discourse field. When such computers are built and made robust enough to be used, history tells us they will have very clumsy interfaces. In the meantime, we have our hands full trying to design interfaces for our current digital tools and systems. We must have them in order to translate the computer's statistical operations into terms that our embodied minds can seize, understand, and put to human use. The need is especially apparent when the database is a bibliographical discourse field. The interface we have built for the Rossetti Archive is dismayingly inadequate to the archive's data set of materials. At present, the archive organizes approximately 9,000 distinct files, about half of which are HTML-XML files. When the archive reaches its scheduled completion date, some 4 years from now, it will have about twice that many files. This is a directed graph of a tiny subset of the archive's current set of analytic relations. We call this Rossetti spaghetti. And I show it to you to give you a graphic sense of the scale and complexity of this grain of Rossettian sand on the shore of the Internet's opening ocean. One can indeed even here see an infinite world dawning in that grain of sand. Well, at about the same time that we cooked up Rossetti spaghetti, the gods arranged for Jeffrey Rockwell to come spend a year at IATH on sabbatical. And during that year, Jeff made an enormous contribution to what was going on in Virginia in curriculum planning, in thinking about research, and in teaching us all something about the importance of play. He also brought with him an abiding interest, going back at least to his work with John Bradley on TACT, in tool building. Tapperware is one of the manifestations of that interest, not only on Jeff's part, of course, but on the part of a whole community. The fact that Tapperware exists is evidence that humanities computing is returning to a focus on tools. And as ever, the tools will bear the imprint of the technological moment in which they are created. What that means in the present moment is that these tools will be networked and distributed, with design influenced deeply by the web and web services. They'll be based on open standards and therefore at least somewhat interoperable. They'll be modular, and if they're properly designed, they'll be relatively easy to extend, to modify, and to personalize. HyperPod demonstrates many of these qualities. I'm not sure how modular it is, but it certainly works on open standards and on the assumption that the network and network resources are available. The actual functionality of the tool is in some ways quite like what TACT offered, but it's networked and it works with texts on the web. The next step in developing a new paradigm for tools in the humanities computing is visualization. This all by itself could in some cases make the investigation of statistical properties of humanities content more interesting to humanities scholars. StageGraph, which is Steve Ramsey's project to graph certain features of dramatic texts, is an interesting example of this. This graph shows the path of Antony and Cleopatra through the play that bears their name, where they intersect, where they don't, what locations they both pass through, etc. This kind of bird's eye view of a whole text or a whole collection of texts makes immediate sense to scholars, provided that the text and the features mapped are both of interest. For my purposes, though, an even better example of the new iteration of tools would be Stephen Sinclair's Hypergraph, which I don't have a slide for because I just saw it today for the first time. And what's significant about that, or things like it, some of which go back quite a while, like the visual thesaurus or star trees, is interactive visualization. The output is the interface. Well, I don't know how many of you have seen this commercially available piece of software called Grokker. Grokker is an excellent example of visualization as interface. It's effectively a search engine or a meta search engine. It clusters results based on their content, and it presents them to you in an interactive visualization. So you can zoom in and out, pick and view items, rearrange groups, and save your new map of the topic. In fact, I'm going to just take a second and show you the actual software in action. This is a map of about 500 results from a bunch of different search engines where the term input was cyber infrastructure. It bears out the fact that this term has more buy-in in the sciences. you have research clusters named things like NSF and sciences. But what's interesting about it is actually that in quite reasonable interface time, you can zoom in and out on these things. You can drag and rearrange things to make your own maps. You can bring up individual results and so forth. And you can save the map and come back to it. The fact that that kind of thing is out there and works quickly at that, makes it clear that this is technically possible. What's lacking is smart text and tools that leverage that smartness and visualizations that are suited to what we understand as the significant features and dimensions of value in the objects of our attention. The notion that we might bring high-level and interactive visualization to bear on the properties of humanities artifacts, now not just plain texts in alphanumeric form, but perhaps also images, sounds, models, etc., brings me to D2K and a project I know some of you have heard of, just funded by Mellon, to build web-based text mining and visualization tools for use with humanities digital libraries. That's a terrible, thorny mouthful. Web-based text mining and visualization tools for use with humanities digital libraries. I'm sure it would send the Board of Critical Inquiry scrambling for their bumper shoots, but I don't know a more direct or concise way of saying it, and I'm not sure that patacriticism is any less thorny. Maybe the figure in the carpet would be better. Finding patterns is the point. Finding them, exploring them, explaining them. D2K stands for Data to Knowledge, and it's the name of a data mining environment built by Michael Welge and his automated learning group at NCSA. You can download it. It has an educational research license for free. It is not an open source project, but they do distribute the compiled code. D2K is a general purpose data mining architecture within which you can build specific data mining applications using a visual programming interface. You can use existing modules or you can create new ones. Arrange those modules into what's called an itinerary and then run data through the itinerary. Outputs can be used to create visualizations or they can be fed to some other process. It's worth noting in passing that the itinerary answers quite precisely to one of the other goals articulated in the Bradley and Rockwell essay in 1992, namely the need in computer-based text analysis to not only have environments that support the flexible linking of tools to meet immediate research demands, but to have the computer support the accurate preservation of those links so they can be fully and accurately evaluated and reused by others. This is basically exactly what the itinerary does. T2K, they have all these other 2Ks. They have I2K. Stephen Downey is working on it. I2K is images, same data mining stuff underneath. I'm sure Stephen Downey's music information retrieval, which is built on top of this, will call itself M2K for music. It's all done in Java. It actually works. It wasn't designed with humanities computing or humanities content in mind. There is this text mining application, but it doesn't know anything really about XML. It doesn't know anything about structured text. And in fact, text mining in the computer science community and in D2K's work to date has mostly focused on unstructured text. There's a lot more of that out there, so naturally that seems like the bigger problem. Stephen Downey, who I mentioned, has been using this for classifying musical data by genre based on its properties. In the Mellon project, we'll be building a data store with content contributed by Virginia, Indiana, Michigan, and a number of other libraries, some of whom I'm not allowed to name. And we'll be building D2K modules that leverage the XML markup to see what kind of benefit we can get out of all the effort that's going into marking up those texts. I think the hardest part in this project will be designing the visualizations for the output of the data mining and trying to figure out what are the features of the text that can be explored with this tool and also are of interest to researchers in the humanities. At a practical level, another challenge will be trying to build the visualization as interface piece of this. But an awful lot of the work has already been done. This is a two-year project. I wouldn't ever have proposed this as a two-year project if D2K weren't there. Over the summer, when we were preparing this proposal, Steve Ramsey and a graduate student at the Graduate School of Library and Information Science named Bei Yu used some of the insights from StageGraph as the basis for an experiment with D2K, in this case to see if structural characteristics of Shakespeare's plays expressed in markup could be used to classify those plays as tragedy, comedy, romance, or history. What you see before you is the result. It's a static visualization of the distribution of properties across texts. What's uninteresting about this is that the software got it mostly right. It grouped the plays largely as they are traditionally grouped by scholars. What's interesting about the results is the one place where the software appears to have gotten it wrong. It puts Othello smack in the middle of the comedies. This struck Bei Yu as a disappointing failure. It struck Steve Ramsey and me as the most interesting and potentially valuable outcome of the experiment. As Jerry suggested this morning, it's not certainty but uncertainty and surprise that's a sign of value and discovery in the humanities. Maybe there is something about Othello at a structural level that makes it more like a comedy than like tragedies. However, there's one other thing. As I said to Brian Cantwell-Smith earlier today, in order for a humanities scholar to know what the significance of that result is, they're going to have more math than I do. They're going to have to understand a little bit more about whether that's an artifact of the particular algorithm that was applied to this body of material or whether they are actually seeing something that's there in the data. There's another thing that I want to mention in the context of tools, and I don't know what else to call them, which is specifically about tools that aim at the visualization of statistical qualities of texts in the aggregate. And that point arises in part from a realization that came up early on in the horribly named ACLS Commission on Cyber Infrastructure for Humanities and Social Sciences, namely the observation that the primary resource constraint for the humanities, at least in the age of the digital representation of artifacts, is the current copyright regime. According to the 2003 study, How Much Information, by Peter Lyman and Hal Varian, our culture produces more than 300 terabytes of print material each year in books, journals, newspapers, and magazines, 25 terabytes of movies each year, 375,000 terabytes of photography, that includes all your stuff on your digital camera, 987 terabytes of radio, 8,000 terabytes of TV, and about 58 terabytes of audio CDs each year, and that doesn't include software like video games or materials originally published on the web. And almost all of that material, including the books, is born digital. And that's just in 2003. With all that cultural material swirling around us, why don't the humanities desperately cry out for computational methods, for big iron, for parallel processing? Because most of it's inaccessible to scholarship, especially scholarship that's based on the representation of the artifact. Each of these books, journals, movies, TV shows, etc., will be copyrighted for the life of the author plus 70 years at least. How will the record of the digital present be copied, even if only to be preserved? How will the history of the future be written? How will the culture of the future sample the culture of the past? If recent changes in the law indicate a trend, then copyright will extend effectively forever. On the other hand, if we had access to all this stuff, and not just from 2003, but say from the second half of the 20th century, then we would need all the computational power and all the computational tools and methods that we could get our hands on just to do the work of the humanities. The reason that I bring this up is that tools which deal with texts in the aggregate or other cultural source material in the aggregate and produce as output visualizations of the properties of texts in that aggregation, provide a way around the copyright constraint. If we don't have to republish the work in order to do digital humanities, perhaps we can get at a greater portion of that record, and perhaps computational methods will then come to seem useful, even necessary, and maybe then tools won't be a dirty word. And this is my last slide, appropriately labeled Endgame. I would agree that at present, humanists don't like to think of themselves as using tools. I'm not sure they like to think of themselves as playing games either. I fear that many humanities scholars actually do believe that they are discovering things, and their discoveries should be taken seriously. I don't know whether the allopoetic will give way to the autopoetic in our understanding of the goals and the objects of humanities scholarship. If it does, then Ivanhoe will point the way to a generation of tools called games. Games, that's a broad category, a category that could and does include simulation, reenactment, exploration, role-playing, detection and discovery, murder and mayhem, nurture, nonsense, and sometimes even sheer abstraction. Perhaps instead of saying to our colleagues, "This is a tool for text mining," we will one day say, "Would you like to play a game of text exploration?" In that ludic future, perhaps, our tools will become our texts. As I look at the Ivanhoe interface, I think I hear it crying out for exegesis. What view of text and reading does it represent? What is the secret sin of the login window? What does it allow us to do, and what does it forbid? Where do its internal constraints, its natural laws, originate, and what does that origin say about the bias and the predispositions of its creator? Well, that's enough. We've spent a generation furiously building digital libraries, and I'm sure that we will now be building tools to use in those libraries equally furiously for at least another generation, and I look forward to it. I'm sure that the text won't go away while we do our tool building, but I'm also certain that our tools will put us into new relationships with our texts. All we can really ask, in the end, is that those relationships should be fruitful. Thank you.